Good morning to you all. Morning to those watching online as well. We're going to take a little break from Colossians over the next month or so. Planning to do Christmas from the book of Isaiah. Isaiah, of course, has some of the great prophecies of Christmas, chapter 7, chapter 9. The virgin will be with child and give birth to a son. For to us a son is born, a child is given, chapter 9. Some of the great Christmas prophecies from Isaiah. But also want to return to and wrap up our 2020 spiritual vision over the course of the next month. And Isaiah chapter 6 does both of those things, the Christmas prophecies and wrapping up spiritual vision. And especially does the latter. In the year the king Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. But in doing the latter, it also is the chapter that sets up a bunch of these Christmas prophecies. So we're going to hear about meeting the king today, the king who makes himself seeable, knowable, and cleanses us. I will tell you that all scripture is amazing. This one's really up there. This is high territory in the Bible. We're going to hear about glory, beauty, and amity. If you want change in your life, it has to start with vision outside of you. Amity just means friendship, peace. So Isaiah chapter 6, I'm going to read verses 1 through 13. We're not going to have time to do the end in any kind of detail, but I at least want it to be part of the reading this morning. So Isaiah chapter 6, he says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, the year the death of the king, Uzziah, I saw the Lord sitting on the throne, high and lifted up, such that the hem of his robe," his hem, "filled the grandest building in the ancient world, Solomon's temple." Him filled the temple. Seraphim were above him. Six wings, two a one. With two, each one covered his face. And with two, each covered his feet. And with two, they were flying. And this one said to this one, "Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh, Adonai Sevaot, Malei Kol Haaretz Kavado, holy, 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 Lord Almighty, Lord of hosts of oaths, the whole earth is full of his glory. The doorposts of the thresholds shook from the voice of the one who called, and the temple was filled, the house was filled with smoke. And I cried, 'Woe is me, for I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, offense meant. I am a man of unclean lips, I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty.' Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, 'Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for.' And I heard now the voice of the Lord calling. Whom shall I send? And who will go for us? And I said, here I am. Send me. And he said, go and say to this people, keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull, and their eyes heavy, and their ears heavy, and blind their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed. And I said, how long, O Lord? And he said, until cities lie waste without inhabitants, and houses without people, and the land is a desolate waste. And the Lord removes people far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. And though a tenth remain in it, it will be burned again like a terebinth or an oak, whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is the stump. This is the word of the Lord. Isaiah was writing at a time of national leadership transition. One leader was gone. A new one was coming to power. National leadership transition. Year King Uzziah died. And in that season of leadership at the head of a nation, in that season, God chose to reveal his glory to his man. What does he say? What's Isaiah say happened? Can you picture that scene? Picture it as I read. Year the king dies. He sees the Lord. He's big. He's high and lifted up. Above the worship center, such that just the bottom portion of his garment fills, as I said, the grandest room in the ancient world. At the mere sight of him, angels are calling to one another, holy, holy, holy. The earth is full of his glory. The building shakes at his presence. The thresholds quake. The building is filled with smoke. Isaiah was having a theophany. Isaiah was having a vision of God. He was having an experience firsthand of the glory of God, face to face, as it were. Isaiah is having one of those times, we might say, he's having one of those times where God is moving from being a concept to him to a reality. God's moving from being an idea that he knows about, even that he believes in, to now God is becoming real to him. And so the question, of course, is, have you ever had that? Has this ever happened to you? Have you ever wanted that? And how do you know if it's ever happened to you? How do you know? How do you know? Well, they cry, glory. What's glory? Glory there in verse 3. Glory is God's weightiness. C.S. Lewis, Tim Keller, and others have said, glory for anything. Glory is that which is permanent, as opposed to that which is temporary or ephemeral. Glory is that which is substantial or important, as opposed to that which is unimportant. Glory is that which is real, as opposed to that which is illusory, passing. God's weightiness is, it means that compared to anything else, God alone is what is real. God alone is what will last. Compared to him, nothing else matters. Glory. You might think of it this way. If you take something that has more glory than water, heavier, more weight, you take something that's heavier than water, denser than water, and you drop it into water, what happens? You drop something, you throw something heavier than water in the water, what's the water do? Splash. It goes everywhere. It trembles at the presence of that which has more glory, more weight than the water itself. If the object is bigger enough, heavier enough, you might say there's a flood as all the water is pushed out. The water flees at the presence of something which has more glory, density, weightiness than itself. You do the same thing with ice. You take something that's heavier than ice and you drop it on ice, what's going to happen? The ice shatters. The ice breaks because the object has more glory than the ice. The ice quakes at its presence. You can picture a power lifter going for that new world record, going for one more rep, and they get to the end and just trembling. It's an issue of glory. That's what glory means. That which is weightier, that causes the shaking, even the breaking of what has less glory. And so here you have the presence of God, the glory of God appearing. And what happens? Everything, the whole building, the greatest building, the whole building shakes, trembles at his glory. You know, this happens everywhere in the Bible that God's glory comes down unveiled. This is what happens. Mount Sinai in Exodus 19, there's an earthquake. Haggai chapter 2, so many of the prophets, they use this imagery of an earthquake at the presence of God. Haggai chapter 2, I will give a shaking. The room is filled with smoke. That's the language from Genesis 15, preached on back in the spring. God makes his covenant with Abram, and the blazing firepot and smoking torch appear. The smoke is the same word here. When the reality of the presence of God, the glory of God comes unveiled, this is what it always does. It always causes a shaking. When the glory of God comes into your life, in any person's life, it will always shake things up. There'll be a rearranging around him. This is the difference between having God as a concept in your life versus having him as a reality in your world. Has he ever rattled you? Have you ever shook at what you were perceiving of him? The difference between him as a concept and a reality is a matter of glory. That's the difference between believing in God and having an experience of God. It's the difference between knowing about and having an encounter with. God as a concept is lighter than you are. You can move him around. You adjust him, what you think about him, around you. You live as if you have more weightiness than he does. But God as a reality moves you around, rearranges your life, your heart, your calling around him. When God is real in your life, he doesn't help you accomplish your agenda. The nice little American dream, security, safety, prosperity. He doesn't help you accomplish your agenda. He becomes your agenda. He radically flips what you thought you were doing upside down. He said, he messes you up. He said, wasn't he a God of grace? Isn't it supposed to be pleasant to be around him? God of grace still shakes you. I would say especially so. I'll show it happening to Isaiah to you in just a minute. But Isaiah walks in, and you notice, Isaiah walks in and he sees the glory of God, and it's been said Isaiah is just like so many of us. He goes into the place of worship, and the last person he expects to actually meet there is God. He's shocked when he shows up. He walks in, he expects to encounter his fellow worshipers. He doesn't expect to actually encounter God, but it happens. And when it does, you notice Isaiah doesn't say, well, what do you know? He really is real. How about that? Nice to see you this week. He doesn't say, what do you know? He's affected by it. It cannot be in your life, I've accepted God, and oh yeah, he's great. I believe in him. And then you go about carrying on with your life. Has your life ever been changed by him? Because this is what glory does to everything, every time. If you believe in God and he hasn't ever radically flipped your life around or rearranged you, you just have God as a concept. You never actually met him, at least not yet. If I suspect we have an awful lot of people in here watching on the wider world web, I suspect we have an awful lot of people in our church family who affirm God. They approve of him. We acknowledge him. We've not yet actually met him. And the proof is in the pudding. He hasn't changed you. You're still living as if you have more glory than he does. You've never shaken at his presence. And on the side, every single person that ever happens for, if it happens to you, you will be aware of some moment in your life where you can look back on and say, that's when it happened. That's the moment when he moved from being a concept to a reality to me. I'm not saying it can only ever happen once. There's no rule against more than one encounter. But there will be at least one time you can point to and say, I'm never going to forget that. I changed right there. However many times you get to encounter him, there's always only ever one first time. And it's not just saying the sinner's prayer, don't you see? Because you can say the sinner's prayer and totally have God as a concept. I want to go to heaven when I die, and off I go back to my life. It's not what we call saying the sinner's prayer that I'm talking about. People do that many times. This is something different altogether. And what I'm talking about, actually, this is what results in the only true sinner's prayer. Woe is me. You always, if it's happened to you, you'll be able to point to it. And in saying that if it's happened to you, you'll be able to point to it, I don't mean it's going to be the exact same for everybody. We read Isaiah 6, he says, do I have to have that experience? And the answer is no, it won't be exactly like that. It's been pointed out, Isaiah is the only person in the Bible that it happens this way for. Everybody else in the Bible, it's slightly different. For Elijah, it happens in 1 Kings 19. You remember? He's on the mountain, and there are all these different phenomena. The wind, the fire, the earthquake, the whisper. It happens that way for Elijah. Take Jeremiah. Tim Keller's got a great sermon on this passage, and he points out, with Jeremiah, the call happens in Jeremiah chapter 1, and it's very, very different between Jeremiah and Isaiah. You see, Isaiah was likely a proud man. He was a member of the cultural elite. Again, I'll show you that in just a minute. But Isaiah was likely a proud man. Jeremiah was very lowly. Sort of a natural pessimistic disposition, it seems. Easily discouraged. And so God comes to Jeremiah in chapter 1 and basically says, get going, stop trembling. Off you go. Don't worry about it. Just go. Stop trembling. God comes to Isaiah and says, start trembling. I've been riding this too easy. It's going to be slightly different for every single one of us, but it will happen, and you'll be able to point to it. Has he ever demolished your life? Demolished what you thought of yourself and re-engineered everything you were about? Isaiah, he already believed in God. He was already a prophet. He was already religious. He was going into the temple to worship. This is somebody who knew about God, yet this is the moment whenever God went from being someone Isaiah knew about to someone Isaiah knew. Has it happened to you? Put differently, the way you can tell is, too, have you seen God's beauty? Have you ever seen the beauty of God? Too. Saying glory is God's weightiness. Glory is weightiness. What's beauty? Well, beauty, we might say, beauty is that which is done for its own sake. There's no other explanation. There's no other cause that's needed. Beauty is whatever is its own reward. You see it in all kinds of different walks of life. You can see it in sports, you can see it in hobbies, see it in music, in art, in fashion. Each has its own kind of beauty. Take hunting. Yes, you can do hunting as a beauty. The way you can tell hunting is being done for the beauty of it, for its own sake, is guy goes off in the woods, spends his whole day out there, not only doesn't get anything, doesn't see a thing the whole day. And comes back in, hasn't seen a thing, comes back in and you say, how was it? And he says, it was great. I was in the woods. I wasn't at work. Didn't see a thing. It was fine. Why? It was its own reward, just being out there. The hunt itself was its own reward. But you take a man who has an empty fridge, and he's going out to get his meal, and he doesn't see a thing, and he comes back in. You ask him, how was it? What's he going to be like? Grumpy. Worried. I didn't see anything. Why? Hunting, for the man with the empty fridge, hunting is not a beauty, it's utility. It's a means to some other end. But when it's for its own sake, its own reward, it doesn't matter how it turns out. It's its own value. That's beauty. You can do it with music. You listen to whatever is your favorite music, and somebody walks in and they say, why are you listening to that? You making any money off of it? Is it helping you get better for your job? Why are you doing it? You look at them like they were crazy. No, I'm not making money off of it. I'm not doing it for something else. I like it for its own sake. That's what beauty is. That's what we're meant to have with God, for his own sake. You get as much of it just for its own, just as much as you can, just because you want it. And you'll find yourself telling others about it. Now, we see this in at least two different ways in the text. At least two different ways. The first one is the angels are calling to one another. The angels call, one called to another. This is not just a statement of fact. This is revelry. This is what it means to be smitten with something, with someone. To say, I can't get enough of it. Look at this. Just look. Just enjoy. Have you seen? They are reveling in God. Look, 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 calling to one another. And what is it he was calling? What is it the angel is calling to the other one? Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. Now, in the Bible, holy, 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 you got to know that in the Hebrew Bible, magnitude, intensity of quality is very often communicated by doubling a word. You say a word twice and it intensifies. It very rarely comes through in English translations. We almost always just say, you know, really or very. Just a few quick examples. Genesis 14. In Genesis 14, we read, they fell into really big pits. That's not what it says in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it says, they fell into pits. They fell into pits of pits, pity pits. You double it, and it's a way of intensifying it. So really big pits idiomatically. Genesis 14. 2 Kings 25. Likely, it best means purest gold. The Hebrew says it was gold, gold. Not just gold. Gold, gold. The purest. The most exquisite. Doubling the word to show magnitude. But nowhere in the Hebrew Bible do you ever have this, except right here. A tripling of a quality. God is not just holy, holy. He is holy, holy, holy. Utterly beyond categories. To get across the magnitude of what is being described. It's tripled. And what is this quality that is so intense? Scholars say that the word, the root family kadosh, read earlier from the Hebrew, holy, kadosh, that word means on the one hand, superlativeness. Infinitely unique superlativeness. The best of the best. So when you say someone has, that God has holy wisdom, it means that his wisdom is infinitely beyond anyone else's. It's infinitely unique wisdom. His love is holy love means it is love that is utterly beyond anyone else's. Superlativeness, but kadosh also means brilliance, beauty. And that's what's going on with these seraphim. They're seeing it, and they're fascinated by it. They can't get enough of it. They're smitten. They're pointing it out to one another. It's becoming what they're talking about. They're constantly crying out about it. Look, it is its own reward, the brilliance of God. Its own reward. And do you realize almost none of us relate to God that way? We relate to God as a means to an end. We use him for other things. We pray to him to get other things. And then when we don't get them, we're a little bit disgruntled or worked up about it with him. Almost none of us relate to God for his own sake. When we don't get what we're wanting for from him, we're upset because he's not what we're wanting from him on our own. Almost none of us relate to God that way. Certainly all of us start off relating to God as a means to an end. It's why we don't talk about Him nearly as much as we do other things. Ask a bunch of people across this church and a bunch of other churches about God, and they clam up and they give you a few platitudes. Ask them about their hobby and off they go. Why? It's a matter of love. It's a matter of how much beauty we have perceived. We've not yet encountered His glory or the beauty of it. Because when you do, you start talking about it. You can't help it. That's how we are, but not the seraphim. They're thrilled with God Himself. And if you've gone through or you're part of it, and thank you to all of you that are part of it. I'm proud of our church last night watching Cradle to Cross. But if you haven't seen, go through tonight and see the very last scene of Cradle to Cross, the seraphim smitten with Him. Dancing, celebrating Him. And Jonathan Edwards said, holiness is the one quality you have to most do this with. Holiness is the quality that's most particular for the seraphim to talk about here, because every other attribute of God we can twist and corrupt and be after for our own sake. You take the power of God, you praise the power of God, it's to your benefit if God has a lot of power and it's on your side. You can twist your love of the power of God for selfish means. You take the wisdom of God, it's to your advantage if you pray to God who has infinite wisdom. You can twist it and make it about you. The mercy of God, it's to your advantage, for your own self-good, that God is merciful so that He forgives you. All of the attributes of God you can make about your own self-benefit, except for the holiness of God. Because the holiness of God is of no use to you. It's His otherliness. His good for His own sake. It's of no benefit to you. And so if you start to adore the holiness of God, that means you're finally starting to adore God for who He is, not for what you can get from Him. The holiness of God is of no use to you at all. In fact, it's actually only ever a threat. Edwards went on to say, the holiness of God means that all of His other attributes are holy, they're superlative. So you take God's power. For God's power to be holy power means you can never ever beat Him if you go against Him. It's a threat. For His wisdom to be holy wisdom means not just you can never ever outsmart Him, but you can never even question Him because He's all wise. All of the other attributes of God combined with His holiness are just a threat. You can never get around Him. His presence, His holy presence, omnipresence, you can never escape Him. And you're at war with Him. The holiness of God always comes at you at a threat. And the way you see it is Isaiah encounters, he realizes the holiness of God, the beauty of God, and immediately he cries out. How can you tell if this has happened to you? Are you ready? The way you can tell is Isaiah sees it, and what he cries out is, look out, woe it on me. He's coming at me. I'm ruined. I'm destroyed. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I've seen. Woe is a curse. It's a malediction. Isaiah is a prophet. That means by pronouncing woe, he is announcing a declaration of judgment, and he is pronouncing it on himself. Why? Anytime you come into the presence of greater glory, it's always traumatic. It always breaks you. It will always shatter you. Coming into an encounter with true glory will always crush you. It shatters the ice. It splashes the water. Take any of those. I mean, it happens just at the human level. Take any of our tiered competitions. You know, you got one round, a local or regional competition. You win there, so you advance on to the next round. So you got a more elite pool of competitors. If you happen to win there, you go on to the next round. If you go through a tiered competition enough, sooner or later, you will meet someone who is so good, who is so much better than you at whatever you're competing in, they will make you not even want to be in the same room as them. Like, oh, I should have stopped back there. I don't belong up here. They're at such a different level. They're at such a higher level. Their voice is so much fuller, sweeter if it's a singing competition. Their brains are so much faster, smarter. Their muscles, their legs are so much more powerful. You meet somebody like that, and then when people start to compliment you, what do? Oh no, you should see them, right? Totally, you think, oh, no, you should look over there. They have shattered your illusion of your own superiority. And so when those compliments come, you have to humbly deflect them to somebody else and find a way to be joyful in that, or you just live with a facade, or you get really, really bitter because you know it's no longer true of you. When I start to get a few too many well-intended compliments, one of the best things for me is to watch a couple rounds of Jeopardy. Because when I watch Jeopardy, I am reminded there is so much out there I don't know. And there are so many people who know a whole lot more about it than I do. It's good to be reminded of that. It's humbling just to encounter human brilliance. Twice in the last month, I have been given a compliment and my wife has laughed. Once was out loud, once was internally. And it was sort of this crossing of worlds from Yale circles back in the day and Franklin County circles from here, because when I get complimented for intelligence here, she's like, I've met his friends in college. And I'll be the first to admit, I've met people, look at them. And one of my Yale friends visited recently, and in all sincerity, he said, he asked me to help him fix some little thing that had gone wrong, manual labor. He asked me to help him. He said, I'm asking you because you're the manliest man that I know. And she laughed out loud. She said, have you met my dad? Right. Just at a human level, you come up against somebody that truly has greater glory than you, it'll put you in your place. And if it's what you've placed your identity, it'll quake you. It'll cause you to tremble. How much more God Almighty? You ever meet God face to face? It'll cause you to say, woe is me. Now, Jewish tradition says that Isaiah was from a royal family. Like, it seems that his father was brother to the king. The king was his uncle. He's one of the elites. We know from his book that he was a man of rare skill. He was a man of artistic, literary, intellectual, communicative genius. If you write a book and 3,000 years later people are still talking about it, you know you're pretty good. He was an intellectual giant. But also it was an oral culture. And that means everything was done through the lips, spoken. And as it's been said, he had the golden tongue. He had the power. Oral culture. And so when he says specifically, I am a man of unclean lips, what he is saying is not just this or that imperfection, not just one area that happens to be a weakness for me, but no, the very best of me doesn't measure up. Judgment on what I thought was my strength pronounces woe on himself. And do you realize how common this is in the Bible? Every single time somebody gets moved from God as a concept to God as a reality, when they encounter the reality of God, they start to hate themselves. Job, I had heard of you, now I see you. What's he do? I repent in dust and ashes. Isaiah here, woe is me, I'm undone. Peter, depart from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man. It's not just an issue with low self-esteem. It's not a negative view of God. Keller says that even if God were only love and he had no justice, no wrath, no holiness, if he were only infinite love and you bumped up against him, you would hate yourself because you would realize, I'm really a cruel person. I've really never actually loved anybody at all. I was always in it for what's in it for me. That's what real love looks like, and I'm not like that. Even if he were only love and nothing else, it would shake you. How much more the full Lord, infinitude of God. The holiness of God is always a threat to us. Here is how you know you've moved into the presence of God. You're starting to relate to him for beauty and not utility, and it has caused radical humility in your life. You realize, I'm a sinner. If anything's good going to come, it's got to be from somebody outside of me, but it's not coming from in here. That's always the effect of countering the glory and the beauty of God. So, of course, the question has to be asked, if that's what holiness does, cause you to shake with regard to yourself, then how does it become a beauty that is celebrated? A beauty that we're enthralled with, like the seraphim. How does that happen? Three. I considered calling this section the amnesty, peace, creation of peace. Considered calling it purity because of Isaiah getting cleansing. But there's something more than both of those. Something far more relational. Amity means friendship. A two-way connection that has now been established. Not just absence of hostility, but positive, good relations. What happens? Isaiah cries out, "Woe is me," verse 6. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had, a burning coal. It's on fire. It's a flame. He brings it, having taken it with tongs from the altar. He brings fire toward Isaiah. You gotta know, remember, everywhere in the Old Testament, when someone unclean enters the presence of the holiness of God, the fire is what comes out to consume them, to destroy them. Leviticus chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu, sons of Aaron, unauthorized entrance into the holiness, fire consumes. Numbers chapter 11, the fire consuming at Taberah, always a pattern. Uncleanness meets holiness of God, fire, whoosh, gone. So here's Isaiah. And he's just encountered the holiness of God, and he's just realized he's unclean, and here comes the fire. Surely he was thinking, I'm a goner. Right? He knows the deal. He's bright. He's a learned man. He's well-read. He's religious. He knows the earlier parts of the Old Testament. He knows the deal. Here comes the fire. And you know it's the fire of the Lord because the angel can't even touch it. He's got to carry it with tongs. Right? The angel can't touch it. And he's now rushing, flying the fire of the Lord toward Isaiah. Isaiah's waiting. I'm going to get it. I deserve it. But what happens? He touched my mouth and said, you're cleansed. Isaiah is not destroyed. Rather, his guilt is taken away. The fire is applied not in judgment, but in cleansing. So you got to ask, how? How does that happen if the pattern is always judgment? It's applied an atonement here, making him clean, not rendering him guilty. How can that be? How's it happen that way? Because centuries later, the shaking happened again. You remember? Matthew 27. The glory of God came down again, and there was a quake. A great earthquake. So great of a shaking that the temple shook in such a way the curtain it just ripped into. Shook. Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And the earth, the whole earth, shook such that the rocks were split. The divine presence comes down so greatly there's a shaking of the whole earth coming down in judgment. And just before, in the garden, it was made clear that no angel was coming to rescue Jesus, like happened for Isaiah. Why? Because Jesus was not unclean who needed to be made clean. No, Jesus Christ was clean. And he was taking on himself the uncleanness so that he might bear that fiery judgment of God and be shaken in our place so that we might receive the fire, not in fullness that causes judgment and condemnation, but just enough to cleanse. Possibly that it stung when it touched his lip. Changes you, but just enough to change and cleanse and reorient, not enough to consume. No angel came to rescue Jesus because Jesus was the sacrifice on the altar under the fire. Jesus was the sacrifice that the angel took and applied to Isaiah to make him clean. And so after this event, Isaiah goes into the trilogy of messianic prophecies in chapters 7, 8, and 9. Because Christmas is all about the glory of God coming down in such a way that we could behold Him and not be shaken in judgment by Him, but quaking just enough to reorient us around Him. That's what Christmas is all about. And when that happens, it will always, always, always send us out on mission. And we'll close here, and as I say, don't have time to do this in detail. Kind of wish we did. Verse 8, Isaiah says, I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send? Who will go for us? And I said, send me. Here I am. Very quickly, the job description, if you read again, you go back and look at verses 9 through 13, the job description that God gives Isaiah is, I'm going to call you to this mission, this job, and you're going to be horribly ineffective at it. You're going to preach and preach and preach for a lifetime and never have any results to show for it. And Isaiah says, yeah, let me go. Why would Isaiah sign on to a mission like that? His life's been rearranged. He's begun to want God for his own sake, not for anything else that would come out of it. Begin to see the glory of God will always send you out on mission, regardless of the results, just because you want to be with Him. Isaiah has just realized the depth of his uncleanness, confesses it, and 1 second later, God says, I've got a partnership for you. This is always the gospel. It will make you more affirmed than you ever thought possible. As Keller always says, make you more firm than you ever thought possible. God's got a partnership for you, but always coming out of more humble than you ever realized you needed to be. I'm unclean. Now go. D.A. Carson, a recent talk at Park Community Church called The Scholar as Pastor, Reflections on Life and Ministry, D.A. Carson concluded his introduction to his talk with these words. Carson said, I should probably say a word about my own pilgrimage. As an undergraduate, I studied chemistry. My intention was to pursue a PhD in organic synthesis. My dream was to do it at Cornell. The steps the Lord took to move me toward vocational ministry were multiple. For a start, the pastor of the church I attended in Montreal approached me one spring and told me he wanted me to intern with him that summer. I told him that, owing to the significant number of college-age students in the church, he was doubtless confusing me with someone else, someone who was planning to head into ministry. As for me, I was headed toward a life in chemistry. The pastor persisted, Carson said, and so did I. We had a 2-hour scrap, and I won. I went to another city that summer and worked in a chem lab. Nevertheless, this pastor, doubtless working out of 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, was the first person who got me to wonder about whether I should be considering vocational ministry. Sometime later, I was working in a chem lab in Ottawa, Canada's capital. I thoroughly enjoyed the work. Nevertheless, I soon discovered most of my colleagues in the lab could be divided into two groups. On the one side were those who hated their jobs and were hanging on until retirement saved them from it. That's how a lot of you feel about chemistry. On the other side were those for whom chemistry was their God. I didn't fit into either group. Meanwhile, I was helping a young minister with his Sunday school in a fledgling work up the valley where he was trying to plant a church. And the challenges of that minor ministry began to capture more of my imagination than the chemistry. Somewhere along the line, the words of a chorus I had sung as a boy played incessantly in my mind. The words of the chorus were this: by and by, when I look on his face, beautiful face, thorn-shadowed face, by and by, when I look on his face, I wish I had given him more. And Carson went on to point out that doesn't mean occupational ministry for everyone, but it does mean a total flipping of your life upside down for everyone. And for me personally, change a few of the names and just a few of the details. And my story is remarkably similar to D.A. Carson's. The undergrad was chemistry. There was a pastor. His name was Josh Moody. He singled me out of all the undergrads who attended his church. The ministry that began to consume my waking imagination was Campus Crusade, discipleship and evangelism of my peers and colleagues. The city was New Haven, Connecticut, not Montreal, Canada. The song was not that particular hymn, but for me it was Jesus, All for Jesus, the revival anthem by Robin Mark. All I am and ever hope to be for you, Jesus. For me, the plan had been a doctorate, not in chemistry per se, but in medicine. I had my career path, though Cornell was nowhere on the radar. Even when I began considering ministry as a career, I will tell you that church ministry, pastoring, preaching, was not even a consideration. And I remember one night, my junior year of college, literally shaking in my bathroom in the middle of the night. Not the types of things that typically cause college undergrads to hover and quake in their restroom in the middle of the night. But for me, crying out, oh God, oh God, oh God, moved to tears. And that night, coming to a personal grip with my sinfulness, and very shortly after that, a call to ministry. I remember standing in our church singing, arms outstretched and upraised, wherever, send me. All I am and ever hope to be, Jesus, all for Jesus. I had a radically different trajectory than what I had expected when I went there. And that song became something of a personal anthem for me every time our group sang it over the next few years. I don't know what it will look like for you. I don't know if it's already happened or if it's yet to come. But I pray that God gives each one here of you a personal encounter with the glory of God. Flip your world upside down and launch us, church, out on mission for Him, with Him. Because that's what always happens when you meet the King. Would you pray with me? Father, your gospel causes us to be more humble than we ever would have feigned on our own. On our own, woe to us, deserving judgment. And so we praise you for the work of your Son, the sacrifice on our behalf, cleansing us, receiving the judgment in full that we might be cleansed, conquering death and rising again. I pray, lead us into reveling in that, your glory on full display in a bloodied man on a cross, down into a grave, rising again, all heaven rejoicing. Lead us to join in the song. Your gospel humbles us. Your gospel exalts us. You call us into partnership with you. Never let that get stale in our hearts, I pray. Having seen you, give us that kind of fullness of your beauty that we can't help talking about it, celebrating it with those who know it already, sharing it with those who don't. So I pray, make us your lights in the darkness this Christmas. In Jesus' name, amen.